Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This is Andrew Horowitz. You know, here's the problem. I hear people that say all the time that they feel kind of chained to their office computer, you know? They spend hours and hours stuck in traffic just to get to their office PC. I know I do it a lot. Stay in the office late at night and never really any time for friends and family. Well, if this sounds like your life, try GoToMyPC. It lets you take your office with you wherever you are and wherever you go. So here's what you can do. You can definitely be more productive from home or anywhere. All you have to do is log on to gotomypc.com at your office desktop, and it instantly appears. Your whole office is right there in front of you. You can use any program, work on a file, check email, and access the networks of your choice. You know, anything that you have in your your remote folders or your defined areas that you have on your PC at the office, right from your laptop at home or wherever you are. Here's what you can do. You can try GoToMyPC free for 30 days, but you must visit gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for a free 30-day trial. You'll be happy you did. And welcome to The Disciplined Investor. This is Andrew Horowitz, and this is podcast episode number 105. Awesome time to be here. Awesome time to be involved in the financial markets. We are seeing such an amazing amount of, well, combination of gibberish and euphoria. Kind of a, as I've been thinking about it, a conspiracy of optimism that we're seeing right now, because it's almost like every day, 6 weeks now running, we've had a market rally off the bottom to bring us right back up to where it fell off a cliff in February. And that's on the heels of an amazing amount of earnings releases by our friends, the financials. And if you haven't seen those and taken a look at those comic strips, I would suggest you do so, because most of those, if not all of those so far, have been absolute acts of fiction. They have been writings that have been only enhanced by the newest FASB ruling, which allowed the mark-to-market accounting methodologies to be, you got to watch me in the air now, I'm doing the quote signal, you know, quote with my fingers, two fingers in the air, quote, relaxed. They've relaxed. Oh, it's so nice to be relaxed. They've relaxed the FASB rulings on mark-to-market. Now, I can probably give you both sides of the equation on why FASB ruling on the mark-to-market had been something that was really beneficial in terms of really valuing assets. On the other hand, I can give you a good discussion probably why it really hurt this market, particularly with, of course, surrounding the financials so much more. But nonetheless, probably the most laughable part of it, by the way, is who the ruling body allowed this to happen, or I should say, because it really wasn't the government per se, right? It was the FSF, you know, FASB, the Accounting Standards Board. But amazingly, they were pressured by regulators. They were pressured by Congress. They were really looked at by politicians and said, this is going to be the one way, with the addition of the short selling rules being not relaxed, but re-strengthened. Whether or not they're going to reinstate the uptick rule or whatever remains to be seen. But I got to tell you, they're not going to do it right away. There's a few months where they need to talk about it. They need to review the benefits of it, and then they're going to make a decision. Now, where are we? Well, S&P in the 870 range or so. The Dow Jones took a huge rally up. NASDAQ has been on fire. We've seen RIM go from 44 when it was at its relative low recently to, I don't know, 67 or so. We've seen Apple move up dramatically, even though I thought it was going to be a really good short. And I still believe that Apple is going to be a reasonable short, because what we're seeing is the amount of unemployment go up dramatically. People are, I guess they're hibernating in a way financially. Let's look at it that way. And then, you know, who in their right mind is going to buy? By the way, disclosure, I love my Apple. We record the podcasts on Apple devices. My laptop is Apple. I have an iPhone, as a matter of fact. My whole family has iPhones and Macs. But The last time I went to a store and I looked around, I said, you know, this is how much? $2,500 for a laptop, and that Dell, that Gateway, that HP is only $750 for almost as much power? Do I really want to buy into that? I don't know. Anyway, what I thought I would discuss real quickly, and then we're going to bring on our guest, Jack Schwager, who is an author, a brilliant mind. I've had the opportunity of getting to know him a little bit, and we're going to ask him some questions on what makes an expert be successful in the world of finance? What makes not only an expert, but a trader successful? He's interviewed the top traders in the world, Jim Rogers and Soros. I mean, just an amazing array of people that he wrote for his books and when he discussed what made them successful and then tied it all together. And we're going to bring him on in a little while, Jack Schwager, and have a discussion with him about the wizards of Wall Street. But I want to talk to you about a little bit was, you know, what's going on and what do I see right now? Because a lot of people have been writing to me, Andrew, what's going on in this market? You know, have we reached the end of this? Whether it's the end of our recession, the end of the really down market, have we seen a bottom yet? Or on the other hand, have we seen the end of the bull run? Is it, in other words, a bear market rally? You know, one of the things that I remember when I was writing my book, I might as well give you a plug right now here. So go pick up a copy at Amazon, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. You'll be glad you did, I promise. But one of the things I was writing the book, and I remember that the editor wrote me back and said, what is this thing that you're calling a dead cat bounce? It's awful. I think we should take it out. And I said, wait, what do you mean? Well, she said, well, I don't want to get the idea of a dead cat. What does a dead cat have to do with investing? And I said, you know, the fact is a dead cat bounce, bear market bounce, whatever you want to call it, you know, is this kind of remarkable event where you see a bounce off a particular level and a move up. Now, what's interesting about this particular bounce is that it has taken stocks across the board up. There was a day about 2 weeks ago that we saw stocks. It didn't matter if they had earnings or really if they've been even seemingly traded in a year or so, move up just amazingly. And this conspiracy of optimism that I talked about, which is great. We need to be optimistic. There's great opportunity in the future. But I want to share a few things to you that we want you to think about because I want to make sure that you are thinking clearly. I do this all the time myself to make sure, you know, step back for a minute. Am I thinking clearly about these markets? Are we making decisions that are based on, you know, hope in the future or on sound financial decisions? And let me give you another disclosure here. Sound financial decisions right now are completely out the window. If you are thinking that the fundamentals underlying this market is why they're trading, nope, that's not true. If you're thinking it's the economics and the future, nope, that's not true either. Because if you look at these green shoots that they're talking about, remember this discussion of green shoots? I'm sorry, they're weeds. Now, some of you are going to be like, oh, bummed out. Andrew, oh, here he goes again. He's getting negative again. And he was a little positive there for a while. And he's getting negative again. Let's just talk reality for a second and use really good investment discipline in order to understand where we are. Okay, let's do some of that. But at the same time, let's like take a second to step back. So I started to look through this morning when I was planning on putting together some of the things for the show. I want to look through some of the news. And I wanted to see what was going on. Now, what I've noticed over the last 2-3 weeks is a definite change in the tone of the media. You know, for a long time, we heard CNBC, them talking about this silver lining. Aaron Burnett, in particular, had talked about the silver lining. Dennis Neely seems to be, you know, aggravated and pissed off no matter what happens. But, you know, there was this kind of discussion of, you know, maybe there was, you know, yeah, we lost this many jobs, but just think it's not as bad as it could be. But let's talk about what we're seeing now. And that's why I keep on bringing us back to this conspiracy of optimism. Not a real conspiracy, but something that I've noticed. And that has to do with the headlines in the news. Have you looked at this lately? The headlines in the news say one thing, and the body of the article seems to say something different. I find that really interesting. Let's take for an example. There's a recent article that said the screen title it says Fisher says U.S. credit markets have gotten stronger. Now, if you read that article just down a little bit, it says Dallas Federal Reserve President Fisher says that the credit markets have gotten stronger and the world's largest economy may grow in 2010. But he says that volatility has been dampened, but it will take some time to correct the weakness we're expecting. But he goes down to talk about how He says that I expect it will get less worse. The numbers will be less negative through 2009. So again, this title of this article, which says that they've gotten stronger, really talks about the fact that they're less negative. Okay, not a big deal. Not proving my point really there. But let's look at the next one. It says China's stimulus restores confidence, shows recovery. China's stimulus restores confidence and shows recovery. That's the title of the article. And then it goes down to talk about how China's rapid reaction in rolling on the stimulus package has resolved some prominent problems in the economy. That's great. But then it talks about, in about one, two, three, four, five paragraphs down, we must be sober and prepare for greater difficulties over a longer period of time, he said. The deterioration of world economies is worse than expected, and a global recovery may be long and a long and winding road. And it says that domestically, China's economy still is facing challenges of faltering exports, excessive industrial production capacity, unemployment, and an unwillingness to invest. So kind of, I'm just wondering, what does that say? There's a couple more I have there. Here's one from BBC. Economy is no longer in a free fall. Okay, economy no longer in a free fall. And then it goes on to talk about that the economy is going to shrink by 3.5% and at least, it says about 0.1% in 2010. However, it is also said that the backdrop of Wednesday's budget is bleak and warned that the chancellor has limited options in his spending plans. Oh, I'm going to go with one more. This is another one. BBC had a few of them that I thought was really interesting, actually. Surveyors report market momentum. So I feel like the old Johnny Carson. So surveyors report market momentum. And then it talks about how when you look at the survey, there's a significant number of viewings, but that remain difficult to persuade buyers to commit to buying a home. This is about this survey. It's about homes, by the way. A new increase in the housing market increased for the fifth. Now, this is inquiries. Interest from home buyers is starting to gain real momentum, although sales remain low. The UK, so it's kind of like a housing report that we see here. And the survey backs up the latest home figures from the council, which suggests that the numbers of mortgages handed out was rising. But it says that it remained tough for first-time buyers, with the CML claiming they typically needed. So in other words, they need to get 25%. They didn't even get there. Again, it's just one more thing. I find I can go on and on and on when I see these discussion of green shoots. Again, we talk about them as kind of weeds right now. When you look at the things like retail sales, they were awful. The economics are awful. And in fact, what's interesting is, as I was doing some research I mentioned before, we're starting to see some cracks in the administration. They're starting to say that, you know what, this recovery is going to take a bit longer than we anticipated. Even though last week we said that we thought things were better, we think there's a lot more work to be done. I think that's on the heels of some of the concerns about the banking issues that we're going to see crop up this week. The Obama administration clearly came out and said that they are still looking to be very, very cautious now. Change of policy, it seems, or change of discussion, a change of maybe the sentiment by the Obama administration. They said that when you look at the banking industry, we are no longer going to put money down a black hole, which if you read between the lines, they're realizing that a lot of the TARP money that was originally spent was not accounted for and maybe just kind of disappeared. They're going to be much more selective. The other thing that you'll notice is they're really, really ramping up on the credit card issues. They're really looking to crack down on abusive credit card expenses. We saw last week that, again, about Capital One is about 9.5% defaults. 90-day delinquencies are rising. So in other words, you go through the, obviously, 30, 60, 90, 90-plus delinquency levels, and they're rising, still rising. We know this. And we're seeing a dramatic amount of problems for Capital One, again, even though they rose about 40 or 50% off their lows recently, because they really, you know, demanded a securitization market in order to get the money to lend money at their exorbitantly high interest rates. The securitization market is all but dead right now. How are they going to get capital to do so? TARP is not going to give them money to raise for credit cards at these obscene interest rates. They already have, I think we calculated, $3.5 billion outstanding in the TARP plan. No discussion about them paying it off. And when you look at one company that may be expendable in this time, I got to tell you something. Out of the 19 companies, banks that are going to go through the stress test, it seems to me that Capital One may be the company that they let go of those, because they don't pose a systemic loss right now. So we're carefully looking at Capital One. The other thing that we're looking at very carefully is there's two things I want to talk to you about, and I want you to pay close attention to these. This is really, really interesting. You know, I've been talking about this whole idea that, you know, what's happening between the 3 and the 4 o'clock hour. Now, we're going to put out a report. We did some research. We gathered the data looking at the last hour of the day, the volume and the price change. In other words, the S&P 500, we can look at the Dow and whatever, but I want to look at the S&P 500 and find out what is the actual returns of the market over last year on a daily basis if we take out the 1 hour of the last hour of the markets. In other words, compare the last hour to the total day in terms of volume and performance. I think we're going to find something very interesting there. One of the things that I know we're going to look at is the correlation of that to the leveraged ETFs. Jason Zweig in the Wall Street Journal put out an article just this week. I'm going to put a link to this on our website. And I've been talking to a few people, which I'm going to bring on next week, that I think you're going to be very interested to hear about, because this is something that's going to be a real issue for the markets, folks. And, you know, even though we identify individual stocks and we look at individual positions, ETFs, etc., you know what? It's been very tough just because of the runaway nature of this market to do anything but obviously be long for the most part. You know, some areas in there that are real problematic. But now, Jason Zweig has an article that says, will leveraged ETFs put cracks in market close? And starts out with saying, listen to this, I could have written this, I guess. At 3 p.m., do you get queasy just thinking about the toll that the final hour of trading might take on your portfolio? New research suggests that on days when the indices make big moves, leveraged exchange-traded funds could trigger a trading cascade, turning the market close into a buying or selling frenzy. Well, we know that. We've seen that. But what's interesting is, in the bottom of this article, he talks about how listen to this. A respected analyst, Anath Madhavan, head of trading research at Barclays PLC's research group for Barclays Global Investors, has released a report arguing that the potential ripple effects of releveraging has been underestimated. Leveraged ETFs usually generate a multiple of the daily market's returns by something called an interest total return swap. So it says, imagine a fund with $100 million in net assets and 200% leverage, meaning that it seeks to deliver twice the market's daily return. So what they talk about here is the amount of releveraging that has to happen and the amount that they're kind of continually adding to the portfolio. But also what I find the most interesting about the discussion here, I'm trying to find where it is here. Here it is. There is a calculation that's done and a, we'll call it a projection, that we know how much, they know how much money is going to be needed to square positions at the end of the day for the ETFs. Barclays puts out a, and a few other firms put out a special report on a daily basis to their high net worth clients that shows the anticipated amount that it's going to take. This is why we're seeing the 3 o'clock move, because investors are getting ahead of that. They find out how much it's going to take on the up or the down to square up the fund, the ETF, by the end of the day, and they get in front of the trade. That's why we see that initial blip up. Then they stop doing it, maybe take some profits, and then they run it up at the end of the day, and then the funds, the ETFs, come in and actually buy more of the position or sell, depending on how you look at it. And that's what's making this all happen. Now, maybe not all of it, but this is a big part of it. We're going to put this article on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I want you to look at this. It's a short article, only about, 10 paragraphs or so. But I think this is going to be something, now that it hit mainstream media, I think that it's going to be something that's going to be looked at very, very closely. In addition, if you haven't done so, I'm going to put some links to a website, a blog called Zero Hedge. We're going to interview the gentleman who writes for that. There are some very, very high-end discussions in there about what's happening with this re-leverage, particularly with the ProShares Double Inverse Real Estate Fund that I want you to take a look at very, very closely. It looks like there is some opportunity. He's predicting that it's possible for us to see just a dramatic, dramatic move on the markets, and SRS, the double inverse negative, to see some mega returns. Interesting. But we'll leave it at that. We're going to bring on our guest. I know you've been probably interested in hearing from him over me. Hopefully I didn't leave out anything that was in my list of things to talk about today. There is one thing. Las Vegas. I'm going to be in Las Vegas. You want to meet me? You want to spend some time? I'd love to meet you. Come on over to Las Vegas and spend some time. Get to know me. Get to know you. Get to know some of the disciplined investors, if you will. And I'm going to be there speaking at the Money Show coming up in May. So if you want more information, just hop on over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and find out more about that and spend some time. Maybe we'll spend some time together. In the meantime, hang on. We're going to be right back. We're going to hook up with our guest for today. Stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And we are back with Jack Schwager, who is actually has an unbelievable resume. He is an author. He is perhaps you know him as the best-selling author who wrote Market Wizards, which actually has a secondary book called The New Market Wizards. And he has also, I guess, a third one called The Stock Market Wizards. But he also is a frequent seminar speaker and lectured on all sorts of topics. And I think he's going to bring a lot of good information from us, not only finding how to trade and what the secrets of the best traders are, but also a little bit about some of the current economic climate that we're facing. So, Jack, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks.
So let's start out with, you know, we've been talking a lot about politics here and there and on the show, but let's kind of get into the whole idea of, you know, trading. You've done a lot of research. You've interviewed some of the greatest traders out there. You've documented these in your book. And, you know, what do you think uniformly is the thread that ties all of the, you know, successful traders together?
Well, actually, that's a longer answer and a harder one to answer. Let me tell you what doesn't tie. Let me tell you what it isn't the thing. What isn't the answer is some sort of market secret or, you know, it's Elliott Wave or GAN or anything like that. So they all have very different approaches. And the thing, one thing I walked away from this whole project was just struck by how different they were. I mean, I had people, you have somebody like Jim Rogers who would speak about technical analysis and say something like, well, I never met a rich technician unless you count the ones that sell their own services. Mm-hmm. And have that type of disdain for technical analysis. And then I met people like, you know, Marty Schwartz, said, oh, I was a fundamental analyst on Wall Street. I lost money 10 years in a row, and I got rich as a technician. And they both were phenomenally successful, and they both were complete disdain for the whole realm of each other's world. You know, one complete disdain for fundamentals, one complete disdain for technical. And yet they both were very successful. So there's no commonality in terms of approaches. So that's a starting point. And there's no commonality in terms of, I'm answering the negative of your question, really. There's no commonality in personalities. They range from former Marine drill sergeants with personalities to match and to people who are quiet as a mouse. So it's kind of an odd bunch in that respect. There's no commonality in terms of education, ranging from high school graduates to to PhDs. So in all these things you might look for, you know, how are they similar, there's no similarity. What is similar and where there are common denominators are in certain traits. And I would say certain things come out. Maybe the most important, and it's kind of a cliche, I almost have to apologize for it, but it's true. And if you ask these people why they're successful, the most common answer you will get, the most common answer I got, is discipline. Mm. And it is really, you know, you say, well, if I can only tell somebody, you know, three things that are important, well, one of those is discipline.
You're not just saying that because of my book, The Disciplined Investor.
No, actually, I'm not. I mean, it's actually true. And in fact, sometimes when I give talks, I say, you know, I'll throw it out to the audience. I say, okay, you know, what do you think was the one answer I got most often when I ask people why they were successful? And then the answer to that is discipline. Mm. So, yeah, so you're a disciplined investor. So you obviously have to share the same philosophy, and it's the correct philosophy. I don't think anybody can be successful over the long term unless they indeed have discipline. And where most people go wrong, it's because they don't have it. There's all sorts of things that have to do more with losing than winning that people don't pay attention to. And of course, risk management is obviously essential, and that's one we can talk about and one which is more commonly understood. But I'll give you one which is on the risk side or on the losing side that's not understood or appreciated, and that is really very important, that did come through in many interviews, and that is an appreciation and an understanding that losing is part of the game.
Mm.
And unless you can actually understand that and accept that, you're going to end up losing. So it's, I mean, the irony is people end up losing because they can't accept the loss. They don't want to be wrong.
Right.
And that, in fact, ends up being the death knell for their account.
It's interesting because in one of your interviews in one of the books, which, you know, The Market Wizards, you talk about, and I'm trying to remember where I read this, but basically that the gentleman that you're talking about was so unsuccessful a few times, he kind of, you know, blew it out a couple of times before he made his fortune. You know, and I know of traders, traders in grains and commodities that, you know, have made fortunes, but they've also lost fortunes several times. It's not, in other words, a direct, you know, flight up. It takes a lot of, sometimes
absolutely,
it takes losses to make money.
But it wasn't the context I meant, but now that you bring that up, that is true. In fact, one of the surprising things is how many people I interviewed completely blew out several times. But that's not the type of loss I'm talking about. And that really is an issue of, that actually speaks more to their determination and their just belief in themselves, and then, you know, just unwilling to give up and come back again and again until they finally got it right.
Mm-hmm.
But what I am getting at is paraphrased best by, I'll go back to Marty Schwartz. I asked him kind of, you know, he went through this long period where he didn't make any money, and then he had this phenomenal period when I interviewed him. He had his 10-year run where he had literally, I mean, it's hard to believe, really. It's documented because he entered these trading contests. But he had this 10-year run where he had literally like two down months. I mean, he was averaging, you know, he's averaging literally 25% a month over that period. It was incredible.
Mm.
So I asked him, how'd you go from this, you know, losing to, and he said, I became a winner when I realized it was okay to lose. And he said, what is a rallying cry of a losing trader? I'll get out when I'm even.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, why is getting out even so important? Because,
right,
he says, because that's, then you can say, I was not wrong. I didn't make a mistake.
Right.
And he said that avoidance of that, trying to avoid that admission is where people go wrong. So it was in that context that I meant, you know, understanding losing is part of the game.
You know what's interesting about that? What's really interesting about that, when you look at behavioral finance and technical analysis, not saying that technical analysis in the context we're talking about it here, but one of the things you look at is things like, VWAP, and you look at, you know, plateaus and where you know people bought in as a resistance point. You say, you know what, at this point, most people shorted. Therefore, then if it goes through that $30, let's say, you know, you're going to start seeing short covering come in. Why? Because people don't want to lose. They'll hold it right to the last second before they lose. And once they do, they'll blow it out and close the position. And it's usable on the other side. If you know that most people have that mentality, you can use that to your advantage. That makes sense?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, that's what technical analysis is, basically, to
right,
exploiting the human psychology.
Right. That's great stuff. I mean, that's really interesting stuff. I mean, how many people just are not willing to take that loss before, you know, for anything, and, you know, they're going to, what ends up happening in this market condition, what happened was they just, you know, rode it all the way down and holding on to it for dear life until they can just come back to even. Interesting.
Well,
interesting.
You've had that in many stocks.
Right.
You've had many, you know, many cases where many stocks that's been the case.
Right. So what else, you, what was some of the things that were just, when you interviewed some of these, I mean, all these people, what was just, you know, some, oh my God, moments that just were just amazing to you?
Huh, I don't know if I have a quick answer for that one. You know, because I had done work, it was really more the amazement part. I mean, what some of these people had actually had achieved in terms of the returns they had made and you know, the compounding of their accounts and that type of stuff, which I actually was aware of before I interviewed them. But during the interviews, I can't say it was like an oh my God type of insight that I walked away from. It was more putting it all together at the end and drawing conclusions of what are the common denominators of success and so forth.
But you pretty much debunked the whole idea that there's a solution in the box.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's what I started out saying, is there is no single magic answer that people search for. And if people who are kind of looking for that, I think are on the wrong path. I mean, that's not, I think people should look for not the magic answer, but really what fits their, you know, what fits their personality. I mean, some people are comfortable, you know, short-term trading, some are comfortable long-term, some are comfortable fundamental, don't try to do something that's not right for you. Find, you know, operate off something that works within your belief system that you're comfortable with, not trying to fit something that you read, somebody else did and was successful. You know, people call me a lot of times, and I get these messages, emails, or I get calls, and they say, look, you know, I read your book and all that. And in the book, by the way, there are a couple of instances, and these are now interviews are quite a number of years old. But there are a number of instances I talked about these traders took on apprentices, and or themselves were apprentices. And so I get this interest that people want to be, you know, so I want to be an apprentice to one of these traders. How can you help me get it? You know, and I'll do anything. I don't want to be paid. and my basic response to that is you know, you haven't gotten to the point where you're even asking the right question, you know, because if you're trying to find somebody else that you can be spoon-fed their approach, that's mm-hmm. the wrong way to do it.
Right.
Which you need to find your own answer.
Right. So do you think that, you know, what would you think if you can encapsulate all these, I mean, again, so many different interviews here that are fantastic in both the New Market Wizards and the Market Wizards, and what would you think that many of these successful traders that, I don't want to say they mastered the market necessarily per se. You know, I mean, yes, okay, but you know, different market conditions bring on different set of circumstances. What if you could kind of, you know, bring a collective conscience to all of them? What would they say about the current conditions that we're in now?
That would be guesswork on my
okay,
part.
Okay, I'm asking for a guess. Yeah,
but I think and if they're also different, they wouldn't have the same response. They wouldn't have the same opinions. But I think one thing they would kind of mostly agree with is that markets are markets, you know, I'm trying to remember exactly what the phrase was. I think Sakota had a good way of, I asked him if the markets were different or had changed and where, you know, compared to the way they were when he was in his heyday, and he says the markets are the same now as they were then, they're always changing, you know,
right.
Something along that mm-hmm. line, and the idea is, yes, we live in some completely maybe unprecedented times, and markets are very different in some respects, but the basic principles really don't change. And
it may just be the depths and the peaks, huh?
Yeah, I mean, markets may be more volatile, they may be reacting to different things, but the basic principles don't change.
So therefore, a master, in your opinion, could be a master in any market condition in any time frame, potentially?
Yes, but that includes knowing when not to do anything. Okay.
Right. Well, you know, we get the story that Stevie Cohen back in October, you know, one of the most recognized hedge fund managers, walked into his trading room in October and basically said to, you know, shut down your computers, close your positions. We're not reopening till the beginning of the year. We're not trading through this. This market is not tradable.
That's actually, you know, that's a perfect example. And Steve Cohen, by the way, Steve Cohen is one of the people I interviewed in the third book, so in the Stock Market Wizards. So that's a perfect example. And you know, you sit with, the interesting thing about this, Steve, is you get a feel for him. Yeah, I'm there one day, and, you know, and I think he was bullish or bearish bonds, but let's say he was bullish that day in bonds, and he's giving me 86 reasons why he's bullish in bonds. And he's saying, you know, he's watching the charts, and he's watching like a million different things at the same time. He's got all these people calling out stuff to him and all that. But anyway, so he has this bullish opinion on the bonds, and he's long bonds. I'm back there the next week, and he's in short bonds. He's giving all the reasons why he's short bonds. But the point is, it's not contradictory. I mean, that's exactly that. In fact, that's a perfect illustration of one of the, you know, we talk about all the attributes. One of the attributes that's really important is flexibility. And that ability to say, oh, I was wrong, it's really the other way. And not only to get out, but go the other way. That's what great traders have, and Steve Cohen is like that. And Steve Cohen is the type of trader who can come in and say, look, this is not acting right, let's just close everything out. And
right.
that is a good example of flexibility, of risk control, of lots of things.
So, you know, one of the things that has been always a thorn in my side has been, first of all, the prepackaged trading programs. We could name them, but I really don't want to name them on the air. Who knows what?
Yeah.
But you can imagine the ones I'm talking about. As a matter of fact, I talk about one in my book, and I change the name on purpose so that we don't kind of get anybody's feathers in a ruffle. But, you know, these prepackaged programs, or better yet, these seminars, you know, and I'll openly discuss this one. Robert Kiyosaki, I think his name is pronounced,
Rich Dad Poor Dad.
Rich Dad Poor Dad. He has this thing that he pawns off as successful stock seminars or something of that nature. I went to one. And I went to one because I was morbidly curious what was actually going on here. And they brought all these people together, and they talked about how the man was making them work, and why should you be working for the man, and the markets are making money for people. And in 30 minutes a day is all you need to free yourself of the shackles of the man, because you could be trading for 30 minutes a day, making yourself $500 or $1,000 a day. And this whole now, of course, that ended with, but you need our $300 program to do so, you know, and our coursework and all that. But we're not selling anything, of course. But you know what? You need to have this program. Point, though, is those kind of things people do gravitate towards. And of course, there's a differential between, I think, education and being sold crap. Let's be honest. You know, there's a differential there. You have to learn what you're doing, of course. But what do we do with these kind of things? And what is your advice to people who are thinking about these pre-canned type of buy-sell programs?
All right. Well, if it's completely black box and pre-canned, my advice is don't do it. And the reason for it is very simple. Let's even start with the premise. Let's start with the premise that the majority, that more than half of these programs are useful and do work. I mean, and that's actually a large leap of faith. But even if that were true, right, it would still end up losing money for most people, for the simple reason is that virtually every program, not maybe every program, is going to hit periods where it's going to do very poorly. You know, so even if it makes money over time, and even if it has reasonably good return to risk, and I'm assuming a lot here, it will still have patches where it does very poorly. And if it is not your system, if you don't know why it's taking out buys and sells, if you don't have a real visceral understanding and belief in it, then when it hits one of those really bad periods, you're gonna dump out, and you'll end up. So even ironically, even with systems that make money over time, people still end up losing because they follow them, and then when it doesn't work, they'll blow out, and then when it starts going, it starts working again, they're not there anymore. So invariably, people will end up losing money if it's just a type of black box, even if it is a system that works on balance.
Well, here, let me tell you a true story. This, and I'll make it really quick. Basically, I had a friend that was looking at this, and he was practice trading for about 6 months. He was making like $60,000 a month paper trading. I asked him how he's doing so well. He said, well, I'm using this program that basically gives me a buy and sell signal, and I just do it. I said, okay. I said, that sounds a little bit crazy, but you're doing well with it. And he's studying it, and he's paying thousands of dollars for the coursework for it and the add-ons and the private lessons and all that. And this is no joke. I'm not kidding about this.
Yeah.
The first month he went live, he lost $60,000. And the reason was because they didn't teach him how to trade and didn't realize that there was no liquidity in a lot of things that he was trading. So when he was paper trading these things, he would buy a stock, a penny stock, let's say, or of some sort, that had no volume, and he'd buy 25,000 shares of it. And then when it went up 2 cents, he would sell it, let's say, not realizing that he's going to get hit by the drag of liquidity in real life. Yeah. So very, very sad.
Yeah, that's an extreme answer. But even if you're trading liquid markets, the problem is that people don't take into account the periods where it's not going to work. I'll tell you an interesting aside here. Back when I was working as a research director for one of the brokerage firms, one of the research things I did was I went through all the records of CTAs, managed futures traders, and you know, analyzing them and so forth. And one of the statistics that gathered was what percentage of their clients lost, you know, closed accounts and lost money. In fact, the CFTC actually collects that statistic. And invariably, you know, there were a large percentage of these managers where the majority of their clients closed with a loss. Well, that's not a surprise necessarily, but what is interesting, it was true even for all those managers that had never had a losing year, the majority of their clients still had a closed out for loss.
Really?
Almost every manager, yes, even if they had all winning years. Why?
Yeah, why?
Because invariably investors came in after they had a run-up. They would hit a poor patch. They would liquidate their account. They would end up walking away for loss, and then the manager would rebound again.
Interesting. That's interesting. Because it's kind of like what's happened recently. I mean, you look at, I'm not sure if this is going to happen recently, but there's been some, you know, amazing stories of Bill Miller, the classic example, who was, you know, leading the pack over 10 years because he would buy on the dips,
right.
Which didn't seem to work 15, so well.
15, I think, yeah. You know,
ridiculous,
whatever.
Just ridiculous. And, you know, who knows if he'll rebound, but, you know, you got to say that if you kept him buying on the dips, some of these financials that recently went up so much, this year should be looking pretty good. You know, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the current market environment that we're kind of involved with right now and talk about, you know, trading and all that. There's been some really bizarre trading issues that have been going on. I keep on focusing and fixating on this 3 p.m. kind of phenomena where we see markets just jump and volume jump on a daily basis and wondering what's going on there, and also looking at there's some interesting discussion about overnight aberrations in futures compared to morning opening values. And I mean, in your opinion, and this is kind of maybe asking a lot, but and if you choose to not answer this, I understand, but do you think there's a lot of current manipulation of sorts going on in the markets today?
Well, I really can't speak to that because I don't know, you know, but I think some that's been raised before, and I think you had on a couple of broadcasts came up this issue of the ETFs,
yeah,
and the leveraged ETFs.
Yes, exactly.
And that may seem kind of bizarre and odd, but it's really just a simple, you look at an ETF and you say, well, why it's a short ETF, double short ETF, and the market's down 50%. Why is this break even after a year? and
right.
that has to do with simple compounding, the math of
right.
compounding.
Right.
And so there's nothing nefarious about this. And some of these, and the reason, actually, the first time I actually looked at it, I had somebody say to me, you know, hey, look at this, you know, and he showed me, but it was the EEM, the emerging market ETF.
Yeah.
And it was both the long and the short, you know, they both, you know, if you had both of them, you know, one kind of,
you lost them both,
right, something
right,
like that. It's like,
right.
How is that possible? And he kind of convinced there must have been some manipulation going on. I never thought about it, but I looked at it and I realized that, hey, you know, all this is, how are they doing this? They're doing this because every day they've got to rebalance. Well, if they're rebalancing every day, you're compounding daily. Well, it's the old simple thing. If you, the simple example, you know, you start out with 1,000. If you make 50%, you've got 1,500. You lose 50% the second day, you're down to 750. You don't
right.
have 1,000.
Right.
So why are you down 25% when you're up 50 and down 50? Because that's compounding.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So let's talk about the current political environment. You wrote a story or a piece for the Financial Times, which people can
right.
actually take a look at it. We'll put a link on our site at thedisciplinedinvestor.com in the show notes, but also you can go to jackschwager.com. All right, yeah, so you wrote this story for Financial Times, Insight, back in mid-March, World of Bizarro, how do you say that word?
Bizarro Keynesianism, yeah.
So let's talk about, you know, there's a lot of discussion about who's to blame, a lot of, I think we've talked about it offline, about not a lot of solution providers, it seems, out there. So, I mean, first of all, let's talk about where do we place some of the blame on a lot of things that have gone on in this environment, and particularly focusing maybe on the credit issues.
Well, it is that boy, is there a ton of blame to go around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't even want to say this is in the right order, but and I don't know if we should just list a whole bunch and maybe focus in. But the blame would be the, and this is not in any particular order, but here there is a lot of them. Running an expansionary fiscal policy financed by deficits and, you know, by increasing deficits and a doubling of the debt during the two Bush terms was reckless. Greenspan's monetary policy of running easy monetary policy mm-hmm. consistently, even as we were going through a bubble economy, was reckless. The failure to have any oversight on CDS to allow a $50-60 trillion market to develop without any oversight, where lots of the participants, such as AIG, were essentially writing insurance, which would then have to be picked up because they were too big to fail, and they are, was reckless. Actually, consumers themselves, by spending beyond their means, by buying houses where they couldn't afford, you know, share some of the blame. Congress, who continually increased spending to fulfill the wishes and desires of their contributors, also, you know, again, returning to the debt. I guess there's lots more, but I mean, that's maybe a starting list.
Well, the list is great, and the problem is great. Let's just face that fact. And the question then is also, just to talk about AIG for a second. I mean, how in the world did this situation, first of all, the former CEO recently, Hank Greenberg, said that, and I'm paraphrasing here, that, you know, this is not his fault, okay? That, you know, under his tenure, this didn't happen. This blew up after he left. But the fact of the matter is that under his tenure, this was all created, it seems to me at least. And
I don't have to get to discern who within AIG is responsible. The point is, AIG took on reckless risk. What they were essentially writing was, you can think of them as effectively writing options against failure, but it's like writing insurance. It's like all your insurance policies are in the same Florida coastal city, you know, and your whole company, I mean, it was effectively like that. I mean, it's like every insurance policy you did was in the same city in Florida, and all you need is one hurricane and you're completely wiped out. Actually, it's worse than that, because in this particular case, the payoff is much greater than the amount that's available. So not only you're wiped out, but you create a debt that's multiple times of the worth.
Well, but what's interesting, Jack, is also that it's kind of an interesting situation. The government, let's just say for a moment that they've taken over AIG, even though it's, I don't know, 80% or whatever. But let's just say they did for a second, essentially have taken over AIG. Okay. If they allow a bank, a company to fail, that there was a CDS written on that would then invoke the CDS payment, if you're following me here.
Yeah.
They would essentially be requiring the government to come in to pay it off. So, two things. Number one, the government can't let AIG fail, because if they do, just correct me if I'm wrong here, but if they do, we have a massive panic because the counterparties are going to freak out that who's going to pay them against the default risk that they've insured against. And secondly, the government is in a no-win situation here of the U.S. because they have basically guaranteed all of the CDS debt here. And if, in fact...
Well, they haven't. No, let me correct. They haven't guaranteed it, okay? But what essentially, it's, you have to look at it this way. Essentially, AIG was providing insurance. You have banks who, let's say, are taking on these toxic assets or whatever, and they say, okay, well, we're buying this stuff, but to protect ourselves, we're gonna buy the CDS insurance. So these mortgage securities go bad, we'll have this other trade here, which is insurance, and it'll hedge. So we're hedged, okay? So you had a lot of banks participating who thought they had a hedge with AIG, and if their investments went sour in some way, they had this other side, this protection. Now, if AIG fails and their other side of the trade fails, then they don't have a hedge, and then all these positions that are supposedly hedged then become outright complete losses, and then you have a whole bunch of banks fail. Now, every bank that fails, everybody has counterparties, and it's not only banks, it's hedge funds, everything else. But you have the whole financial system. Once you have these CDS defaults not honored, and sometimes they're resold, and there's a whole linkage of, it's kind of difficult to even trace who's the end party. But once you start, it's a domino effect. Once counterparties start failing, their counterparties will fail. Their counterparties, it's like a contagious virus. And I think there's really a very real chance that if AIG was allowed to fail, you could have had a collapse not only of the financial system in the U.S., but of the whole global financial system. A complete collapse as counterparties all over started failing. And even banks which had no problem would have positions with other banks and other obligations that would not get honored. And nobody would know what's good, what's not good, who's the end party. And the whole thing would have just,
Well, let's say that, again, this is not happening, but let's say that, I'm just picking one, that the government steps in and nationalizes/bankrupts Citigroup. That's to say, okay?
Right.
It's going to invoke the CDSs that were issued by AIG requiring massive payments of the CDS obligations to the counterparties, right? So the government has a disincentive to do that.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that issue, honestly. You know, about the effect of a Citigroup if the government took over and
well, that's why Fannie and Freddie are pretty much not, they're not bankrupt. They're just hanging on by a thread, zombied, because the government doesn't want to invoke the required CDS payments.
Yeah, and that's another aspect. You know, what the ramifications are on that, and what the state, you know, and what the CDSs on those have done. You know, obviously, they would have to have been marked down almost. You know, they would have to reflect that to some extent. And I'm not, I don't know offhand. So
yeah, no, I'm just saying that seems like a logical progression to me, and that's why I think that some of the question of why is this not been done may be out there. I mean, questioning whether GM is going to go through a bankruptcy or not, I think one of the questions the government has to ask is who is insuring this CDS debt? Who's insuring it? I mean, just as a matter of course, they have to wonder where that money is going to come from and who's going to have to pay it.
Although there's the other issue, the government, the whole problem with the government not taking over in some cases is essentially that if these banks do recover, then the taxpayer doesn't, will get a very limited benefit. And if they, if they continue to eat up money, then the taxpayer keeps on subsidizing. Mm-hmm. It's the old cliche socializing the losses and having capitalist.
Well, it's not, unfortunately, it's not a cliche anymore.
Yeah,
it's a fact. What do you think about the emerging markets? I mean, we're seeing an amazing regrouping in China and Brazil, and it's quite astonishing. I'm still wondering whether it's solely because of commodity issues or it's because they can flip so much better on a dime. I'm almost embarrassed to say that aside from the Europe area and the U.S. is looking pretty weak these days compared to some of the emerging markets, the way it looks to me, at least.
Well, yeah, I think financial in terms of financial terms, China is, let's taking China as an example, is actually much better. You know, they got surpluses instead of huge deficits versus the U.S. The interesting thing in China, of course, is you have this huge, because they're so, I mean, China's more like the U.S. might have been 100 years ago. I mean, there's a large untapped middle class to develop. And so there's lots of room for them to grow. They haven't. I mean, they've been oriented towards an export economy, but theoretically, if they could reorient their economy to be more domestic consumption, they would have tremendous potential to grow. They've got plenty of surpluses to use, and in many ways, they're in a much sounder position than the U.S. is.
Yeah.
Used to be a time where the emerging markets were got hit for very good reason because they were in deep debt, they would default, and so forth. But you've gotten to this odd situation where the U.S. is actually in some of the other G7 countries are in considerably worse shape economically than some of the emerging markets.
Yeah, so I think Jim Rogers was ahead of the curve on that one, huh?
Yeah, well, he's usually right on his long-term prognostications, and I think there are good fundamental reasons why countries like China and even Brazil should be doing better than the U.S. And I think they actually went down more than the U.S. market initially, and I think that was simply a matter of money flows, people just redeeming of everything, and it sort of hits harder there. And also because of the export hit, obviously having a very direct effect. But even after all the smoke clears, they're still in better shape than we are.
Right, and the markets are, some of them are even up, not only up, but up substantially. 2009, I understand there's only a snapshot of time because they're still maybe down 50% more potentially. But all right, so summing this all up, so we talk about, the great traders out there and what makes a good trader and what potentially doesn't. We talk about a little bit about some of the great names that you have. What else can you add in terms of people listening who, are interested in managing their own money or at least dabbling? Or I mean, what kind of tips can we give them?
Well, okay.
Except for tips.
Are we talking about new traders or existing traders, or what are we talking about?
Let's talk about people who know about the markets, are scared right now in terms of what's going on in the world of markets, and want to get. Let's talk about new traders.
Well, I think there's a certain progression one needs to go through. The first step I think always is educate yourself. So read mm-hmm. a lot. I mean, there's a lot of good advice and cheap advice in terms of, I mean, books don't cost that much money. and sort of get educated. And that's step one. Step two is, begin following the markets, assuming you have an interest, obviously. Begin following the markets, develop some sort of approach. Step three is start to apply that approach, maybe with paper trading or just watching the market or whatever. Step four would be, okay, take a small amount of money and actually start enacting that approach, mm-hmm. and see how it goes. And it's important to take the step from paper trading to real money because things change for real money. But the other important point is not to take so much money that if you lose it, it's going to be a problem, because most traders will, in fact, wipe out or do poorly, maybe not right away, but in that first phase. So it's important to get experience with a smaller amount of money and have the ability to retry the experiment once you learn more. So the step is try it in the real markets, but mm-hmm. with a amount of money that you could afford to lose and wouldn't change your life.
Right.
And then the final step is once you really have confidence and you really feel you know what you're doing and you have some sort of method for controlling risk, then actually begin in a more meaningful way in terms of the amount mm-hmm. that you commit.
And I'm jumping around a little bit, but I want to kind of follow up on something and ask this, and we'll close it up with this. What do you sure. see as, again, I'm skipping around a little here, but what would you see now as a relatively appropriate, I don't want to say solution, but direction that we should be going? A lot of comments about don't throw money at it. Some people that say let things fail, but yet that's not a good solution either, right?
That's a very interesting question. Yeah, and people do say that. And the question is, of course, what happens if you – and I think one problem – in fact, some of the people you've had on your show, one of the things they kind of don't really pay attention to, they're easy to say, oh, we're building up all this, all this debt now. Well, first of all, we built up a tremendous – we doubled the debt before Obama even got here.
Mm-hmm.
But that aside, the point is we've got a situation. Now, let's say the response of all the stimulus may there's a real concern here, and it may actually lead to a situation a few years out where you have potential inflation coming out of that, and we may have a choice between severe contraction or running into, I hesitate to say hyperinflation, but something that is very serious on the inflation side. So we may be faced with that very, very dismal choice between two very negative alternatives. So, yes, that is a real concern. But what if you don't do anything? And if you don't do anything, the fact was that we were in a situation where we were at a downward spiral, or a deflationary spiral, as economists would put it. And essentially doing nothing when consumers stop spending and businesses stop spending, then it's a simple equation. It's consumers plus it's consumers plus investment plus government. There
right.
is nothing else.
Right.
If you have no if consumers stop spending, and businesses stop spending, and if the government isn't taking up some of that slack, then you can contract and contract, and the more you contract, it becomes a feedback loop. And you do reach situations. We had it in the Depression, and we were at the threshold of having it here. If nothing was done, there was a very real chance that we would indeed end up with a Depression-type situation. So it's kind of easy to say, don't do anything, don't increase it. But what is the other side of that coin? So I think that's often not addressed. So if you're not doing anything, what are you doing?
You've
got to offer some solution. And the other thing, which is maybe a little bit maybe not pleasant to think about, is there may not even be a solution. The economy may have been run so poorly and so many mistakes may have been made that by the time President Obama walked into office, there may not have been any strategy that would work long-term without creating big problems. If he did nothing, we potentially have a depression. If he's doing what he's doing now, he may end up with a potential runaway inflation in a few years that can't be controlled.
But Jack, nobody in the last 10 years, I'm just using a time frame here, nobody was wise enough to say, you know, things are not going in the right direction here. Not one economist, nobody? I mean,
I don't know about nobody. I mean, there were certainly a lot of critics and a lot of, certainly there were a lot of critics on deficit spending in an expansionary economy. I mean, certainly.
I'm talking about nobody in government. Nobody in government.
Yeah, well, in government. In government, people, you know, well, of course not. First of all, you wouldn't have it in the administration, because anybody who disagreed with that administration was out the door. I mean, think of Secretary, Treasury O'Neill, who was a good guy and really said right early on, you know, hey, we can't do this. We're gonna really run up deficits, and wasn't very long. You know, to which Cheney said, you know, deficits don't matter. This is Republicans, right? Deficits don't matter, and it wasn't long after that he was shown the door. So you have to have lockstep agreement with anything that was done. So you would get no disagreement there, because anybody disagreed was not going to be part of the administration. As far as the Congress, well, you know, you've got your various evils on both the Democrat and Republican side, but each side kind of adheres to its own ideology, and again, you don't get much variation on either side.
Do you think we're out of the woods? Are we out of the woods?
Out of the woods? No, by no means. Well, you know, there's two aspects. Are we out of the woods in terms of the immediate near term? I don't know if we're out of the woods, but I think there's a reasonable chance that we might get some sort of, you know, recovery, because there's enough money being pumped into the economies that you might get some sort of, you know, stabilization and maybe rebound. But we still have the problem of paying this back.
and so you
may run it. What I think, I hesitate to forecast, and I should preface this by saying, you know, that warning everybody, don't listen to me as a forecaster, because, you know, I'm no better than anybody else. But my own guess of what may happen is you'll get some sort of a stabilization and rebound, but then you'll be faced with the need to sharply cut back spending to avoid the deficits getting any larger and avoid the inflation, and that will cause another kind of what do you call it? You know, a W type of recession.
Yeah.
You know? So,
well, what's interesting is that I think is very real also. But I just the only thing that is that I have been so reluctant. You know, everybody's saying, oh, you know, fourth quarter out of this and thing, we're back to total growth here and all that. But it seems to me we're not seeing any indication of that, and just a lessening of a downward slope doesn't cut it for me yet. I need to see some real evidence, and aside from, you know, a little kind of bend. I mean, yes, clearly, you know, we've stopped the spiral at this point. We've stopped the spiral down, and consumers, I don't think they're spending yet, by the way, from every indication I've seen, but at least it's not like they've totally holed up and disappeared off the face of the earth, comparatively, you know what I mean? But it's a very tough one right now, and I think there's a lot of, right now we're at the precipice of, you know, more so than before, we're at the precipice of where are we going next. It was very clear for a little while where we were going, right? You know, it was very clear we're going down.
Yeah.
Now there's a big question. I think that, you know, this everyday nuance of the economics leads to some very interesting discussion. Anyway, Jack Schwager, I could spend hours talking to you. Your books are fabulous, The New Market Wizards, Market Wizards, and your third book and all that. We're going to send everybody right to your website where they can pick up copies, and I encourage you to do so. If you are interested in understanding about successful trading, you need to read these books. Also, if you want to check out his latest article from the Financial Times, we'll put a link to that as well, The Insight, The World of Bizarro Keynesianism, where he talks about who's to blame and maybe some of the solutions on what to do. And I thank you very, very much for joining us here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Yeah, pleasure, Andrew. Thank you. Bye.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for today. Thanks for Jack Schwager. I will put the links to his book and his website on our website, and I hope that you spend some time checking out his stuff. It's really brilliant. And until then, don't forget about Vegas. Don't forget about signing up for Twitter. Follow me on Twitter. You'll find all the latest updates on the blog. MSN I write for as well, MSN Money. We have some cool things that we wrote about the real estate markets, the commercial real estate markets last week. And we have some interesting things happening there as well. So I'm glad you're listening. Thanks so much. Don't forget to come by for next week. And do me a favor. Go on over to iTunes and leave a couple of remarks. Leave a little rating there for me. And don't forget to listen to DH Unplugged. That's the Dvorak and myself. We talk about some cool stuff on that show. Go to dhunplugged.com. You can also go to iTunes and sign up for that as well. It's all free. It's all fun. We'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.